EMSradio.com.
EMS information for the next generation.
The EMS Garage is a production of EMSradio.com. You can find us on Facebook, just search EMS Garage. You can find us on Twitter at EMS Garage. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com, or call us, 303-720-6001.
This episode of the EMS Garage is brought to you by Audible.com. Over 85,000 titles to choose from in every genre: thrillers, business, romance, comedy, sci-fi, and more. Get a free audiobook download for your MP3 or iPod. Just go to www.audibletrial.com/EMS Garage.
The EMS Garage.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. I'm Chris Monterey, your host, and this week is Bring Your Own Topic Week. Yes. However, apparently Tim Noonan thought it was Bring Your Own TB Week, and I'm glad we kind of set him straight because, goodness, we didn't want to give you TB over the, over the intertube there. So I promise you we won't be bringing you any TB or any other kinds of things. So I'm your host, Chris Monterey, the Geeky Medic on all those websites. You can find us at EMS today. In just a few short weeks, we'll be in booth 1811, and we'll be very close to the GEMS booth, very close to the front door, which makes a lot of us happy, especially Jamie Davis when he has to run and puke during the middle of the show, which is a lot of fun. Just ask him if you see him. He'll know what you mean. And we're pretty excited to be there. GEMS is sponsoring us, and there's going to be, we just found out tonight, there's going to be a meetup at Uno's Cafe. So if you can't come down and join us at EMS today, you can at least meet us at Uno's Chicago Pizzeria or something. Anyway, last year we had kind of a small little section of Uno's. This year, they're giving us the whole place. They said, hey, you guys did a great job last year, so come on and bring the entire crew and just take over the whole event. 300 drink tickets. If you come in the door first, we're going to give you some drinks, and that's sponsored by Go Forward Media and GEMS. So come on out and join us. We hope to see you there. So tonight we have a great panel, as always. Joining us first, Dr. Jeff Myers. Hello, sir.
Good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How have you been?
Very good. Very good.
Getting more snow, or, well, it's Buffalo, so whatever.
No, we're in a deep freeze.
Oh, sorry.
That's right. It does keep the snowfall totals down. Yeah. We sent it all down to New York City.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Well,
we wanted to share.
And they've been getting a lot, but I spoke out of turn last week because up until 2 days ago, I could see my lawn for the entire winter. And now I have about a foot of snow on my lawn, and it won't go away till about March. So doggone it. I was hoping to get out. I actually had to start my snowblower for the first time this year. So, oh well. It was fun. It was fun while it lasted. But now we're in winter here in Colorado. So yay. So joining us next from New York City, or well, not really New York City, but we'll make him say it, the Bronx, David Koenig. Hello, sir.
Actually, it's Queens.
And oh, yes, Queens! It is part of New York City. I am so sorry to insult you that way.
Yo, Queens, awesome.
Word.
Sorry, I thought it was Bronx. Anyway, how are you? Have you dug out yet?
Yeah, no, I'm dug out. I'm good. I got my diet cherry Pepsi. I got my blackjack gum. Nice. You know, it's just really, really cold out. Like, my breath froze in front of my face this morning cold. So,
have you ever done that thing where you take the hot water out and you throw it out and see how really cold it is?
Yeah, like the boiling water and then you throw it in the air and it like evaporates into like micro particles or something.
Yeah,
it's actually pretty cool.
That's a fun thing. Yeah, it was 25 below here recently, so we got to do that too. It was fun. Well, thanks for coming on tonight, and hope you stay warm and chew your gum. Also joining us tonight is the one and only Maris, and I can't pronounce your last name because I can never pronounce your last name. I want to say Schwager, like sugar, but it's not. So tell me your last name.
It's Schwager.
Schwager. So I just want to say it with... Well, anyway, so well, how are you?
You can say it like German, Schuhwager.
Ah, that'll help. Schuhwager.
Yes, but most people know me as Sam, Medic61.
Very cool.
Not many people know me as Maris, but...
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. I just...
I know you as Maris, and that's what you're going to be known as for me.
That works for me. I'm known as Maris on Gen Med, so I can be known as Maris.
That's correct. Hey, and what is the deal with that show? You guys haven't recorded a new episode in like... ever.
It's been a while. We had some shuffling of hosts. We've all been incredibly busy. I started nursing school. Wow. Scott started his paramedic program. Things sort of just got hectic, but we are making a comeback, and we will be at EMS today doing some podcasting.
I know, and I'm excited.
We are thrilled.
I know. And so it's going to be you, and it's going to be Natalie.
And well, Natalie's. And Scott can't make it this year, but he will definitely be there in spirit, and we have an awesome show lined up.
Very cool. Well, maybe you guys can make it to Vegas.
Oh, I will be at Vegas.
Yeah, we probably won't be seeing you podcasting, though. You could be like, we're the Gen Med show. We're out having fun. Oh, wait, it is Vegas. We'll all be out.
No, we will definitely be there podcasting. Very
cool. Well, thank you for coming on tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Right on. Also joining us from... The middle of the country, the Midwest, as it were, Iowa. Brad Buck, how are you, sir?
I'm very good tonight. Thank you.
Good. Are you okay? And you sound a little down.
No, it's cold.
Oh.
My outside temperature minus my wind chill is -4 right now, and it's going to be a lot colder.
Yeah.
So at least this morning it was that cold, but there was sunshine.
Oh.
Yeah, it makes you a little more cheery.
I like those days where it's really, in Colorado we get this a lot, where it's really like bitterly cold out and it's blue sky. So you're kind of lured into this false sense of security, like, oh, I can go outside. It's so sunny. And you go outside and go, man, my nose hairs are freezing when I breathe. You know, one of those kind of cold. Oh, yeah. Oof.
Yeah, one of those for today. It's bright sunshine. It's almost blinding blue sky and dead below zero.
Ooh, cold. Well, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. And it's Bring Your Own Topic Week. Yay. So I wanted to ask you guys, we were going to talk about, well, one of the topics that came up in the weekly discussions was documentation. And wanted to see, do you guys want to talk about that tonight? Or you can talk about a topic that you want to bring along.
I'd be thrilled to talk about documentation. I just recently had a conversation with a coworker about that, so it's fresh in my mind.
All right, so let's start there. I'm going to give you my personal bias that good documentation doesn't always necessarily translate into good treatment. However, I think that people that document well, often if they're that careful about documenting well, that they're treating their patients well. Personal opinion, but I'd like to get your guys' thoughts on that.
I can see where you're coming from on that. I find that I document meticulously and thoroughly because I am terrified of being in court and not remembering a call. so I think I document almost to the point of obsession for covering myself. And I know that I definitely don't work with people who do nearly the same.
I would agree with her completely. That is part of my justification for the way I do my documentation, the way I type up my reports, is because I learned early on that by not putting things in a certain order and a clear view for those who may be reading it, such as the lawyer, I want to do everything I possibly can to either A, avoid having to be on a stand because they didn't like the way a report looked when it came down and they decided to move forward with some form of a lawsuit, but also so I can remember, and by looking through that, I may not get 100% of that callback in my mind as far as, you know, being able to visualize it, but I will, it'll be a lot clearer, and I could go off of the report as far as what I did, possibly, you know, when I did it and how I did it. So, and I come across other people's reports that if they're ever on the stand, they would fail miserably, absolutely miserably.
Okay. So, if you read most of my reports, especially from many years ago, you would find that they're all remarkably similar. And I've talked about that before on the show, that, you know, it beyond the pertinent negatives, there's not a lot to add. And I don't know, maybe that's good or bad, but everything's the same. The treatment section you'll find in the same place. The assessment section you'll find in the same place. All those things. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that's not a bad thing, but I think the other point that came out this week is if you do 100% QA, or is 100% QA good, first off? And secondly, does it really bring out people's, I don't know, bad tendencies?
Yeah, what you're saying about every report looking very similar, I think, as far as my perspective, is that that's a good thing, and it shows continuity, and that you are just doing the same thing. So when you turn over your reports, I find that doctors will say to me, you know, like, I like the way you write your report because everything is there. I know where to look for it, and I'm never missing anything. So because I write it the same way every time, I never leave anything out. And that I found that providers really appreciate that. I don't know if everyone does, but at least the providers I've worked with do.
You know, what's funny is, you know, when I first started out, you know, I was taught basically the same way. Document every call the same way. You need to document defensively. They called it actually defensive documentation for that time when you actually were called into court. And I always found that, you know, the times that I did get called into court, even though I followed exactly, you know, the exact same thing, but that was actually an issue. You know, because I had a lawyer who had the ACR from the patient, and then he also had them pull 25 ACRs over, done by myself over the past year. And, you know, now I use a state form, so all the boxes are all the same, but they were very, very identical. And so therefore the lawyer's like, well, is every single patient the same? You're documenting every single patient the same way. It's, you know, and it kind of like was like an eye opener to me in that, well, you know, he's right. Not every patient's the same. And therefore, you know, if I document the exact same way for every patient, then, you know, is that because I'm being thorough or because I'm being complacent and just going through the motions of, you know, negative JVD and positive pulse neurosensory times 4 and ANO times 3 and, you know, all the standards? Or, you know, am I actually documenting about the patient that I'm actually treating and transporting? And, you know, after that experience, over time, and it definitely wasn't instantaneous, my documentation style has definitely changed. I can't say whether or not 100% QA is good enough for an organization. I know for my volunteer agency, we do 100% QA. It's a lower call volume than most agencies. We're only looking at maybe about 50 or 60 runs a month, so it's relatively easy to do. We catch mistakes, you know, we point out, and you know, people progress. Does that necessarily mean that the treatment is any better? Well, no, it doesn't mean the treatment is any better. It just means that, you know, because of, you know, the way that we view it, that every patient is an individual and needs to be treated and documented uniquely, because that's what they are. They're unique individuals. You know, perhaps those EMTs and medics won't, you know, buy into the whole defensive documentation argument.
Chris, something I can say as far as the my standpoint on it comes from, you know, when I was a basic, I worked for just a short period of time as a basic before I started paramedic school for the most part. And paramedic school, my preceptor, while I was doing my field time, I wrote a couple of reports the first day. And he was reading through them, and he said, we've got to work on this. Is, you know, they were kind of here and there, and there was no organized fashion to it. I really hadn't developed a style. And the service that he was riding with, they had done, they had a chart method, and that's what they preferred to have people write, but didn't force it. So he showed me his, kind of where he put things. So I adapted that, and over the years then I've gone off of that and kind of developed my own modified version of it. And a few years into being a paramedic, I made a switch on some things and didn't start to document the same and write my reports the same. And suddenly I'm getting questioned by my chief because the picture wasn't quite as clear. The same thing was coming from my medical director, where, well, it doesn't seem like you're doing what you should be doing, and if you are, you're really not documenting it clearly here. And so since then, I've gone back, and I've never deviated from the way that I write up my report. Now, something Dave was saying there, you know, some of the general things we should be doing, whether you have a trauma patient, a medical patient, a refusal, any of those, you know, we should always be doing an in-depth neuro assessment. There's certain things that every report should have as a part of it, in my opinion. And I think probably from a legal standpoint, that stands true also. And then from there, I mean, my report, the way it sits and kind of the way that I lay it out, but I add and subtract information if I do it or not. You know, a code or a big trauma might have a lot more in-depth on some head-to-toe assessment than something maybe not quite as severe.
Well, and I agree that painting that picture is important. Dr. Myers, what do you – I'm assuming that you get to see a lot of reports coming through the ER, but how many – or what do you view as a good volume of QA for yourself covering several services?
The QAing, the documentation is just one aspect of QA, and that was a little bit of the conversation that went on offline when we were talking about topics for this show. That's only one component. It'll tell you how well people document. As everybody has said, we need to improve our documentation. We always can improve our documentation. I'm still finding things after 24 years now that I can improve. I look back at charts I write in the emergency department. But it's only one aspect from a QA standpoint. I think it needs to be directed. One thing that I started doing with one of my agencies as a pilot was take a look at the types of calls and let's look at things that mean something. For example, are we doing 12 leads on all patients who complain of chest pain or have acute coronary syndrome type symptoms? That's an important thing that makes, from a medical standpoint, that's an important thing to do early on. You know, are those patients getting aspirin? Some of this, similar concept to what the government's doing for us in the hospitals, certain things that are picked out as quality indicators. I think that's a little bit better way to tell how, at least from the documentation, how well our care is. Now, completeness of documentation, I think, from a supervisory standpoint, Chris, you can probably chime in on this one, I think gives you an idea of the level of professionalism of the provider. I mean, I can understand somebody getting up to a new level, the documentation is a little iffy, and working with preceptors to improve that. But if it's your person that's been with you for several years and their documentation is sloppy, that you got to wonder if the care is sloppy. You got to wonder if their customer service is sloppy. Those type of things. From the QA standpoint, I don't think there's any substitute for actually getting out there into the field. But it's very hard to do from a medical director standpoint.
Well, then, what as a QA number do you want to see? Do you want to review 50%, or do you want to review every cardiac arrest? I mean, how do we come up with a good plan for QA in our organization?
I think looking at the – well, one way – depending upon the volume of the service, lower volume services, it's feasible to look at every chart. Higher volume services – for example, the one service I used to be a medical director for does on the order of, 60,000-70,000 calls a year system-wide. There's no way that you're going to be able to look at every single chart. You have to identify what are the high-risk calls. Refusals or non-transports are high-risk calls, because you're leaving the patient without medical care. Airway management is a marker for a high-risk call, not only because of the airway management procedures, and I'm not meaning to get into a whole intubation discussion or that type of thing, but usually if you got to manage somebody's airway, they're pretty sick. So that hopefully gives you a subset there. And then I think periodically looking through, whether it's by call type, whether it's by totally random across the board, you know, some way of getting the assessment of whether from the documentation, and you use that as the surrogate, but from the documentation, you know, are we caring for these patients in, you know, an acceptable manner? If yes, awesome. Give positive feedback back to the providers. In a public way. If not, then let's hit that in the next education update cycle, whether you're doing that monthly, whether you're doing that quarterly, however you're doing it, that feedback's got to go back to the organization. Without that feedback, the QA is useless.
Very good point. And when I think about looking at chart review, I guess my overriding concern when I'm reading people's reports or whatever is not necessarily looking at, okay, did they manage an airway well, but their decision process behind it. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of painting that picture when you're writing that all important black and white picture of what you did on scene. And I think oftentimes people can get lazy with it and not necessarily let people know, or let me know, the reader, why you thought that way. What was your differential? Why did you get to that point? What else did you consider before you went to X versus Y?
That's a very good point, and that's not something that, at least when I was teaching EMT class many years ago and going through paramedic class and stuff, that wasn't something that medical decision-making wasn't stressed in terms of the documentation. And that's an important point, important thing to add, exactly for that reason. You know, why you've got somebody who fell off a bar stool, had a head injury, intoxicated, with a lack on their head and a loss of consciousness, and you didn't backboard them? You know, why the hell didn't you backboard? Well, in the medical decision making, the patient was belligerent, had to calm the patient down. Patient accepted cervical collar, but adamantly started to become agitated and violent when trying to strap him down to the backboard. You know, all right, that paints that picture, like you said, that we can't go all the way where we want to go, but we're going to get this person to the hospital to get looked at, and we're going to keep them calm doing it. Just as one example. You know, why did you do something? Why didn't you do something? It's something that I even see as deficient in our resident documentation, and trying to give the feedback there to provide that insight that you can't get from just looking at the normal SOAP note type format.
What do you guys think?
I definitely agree with that. In that, any time I'm in a questionable situation where I do something that isn't standard or what we would normally do according to protocol, I document with quotations out the wazoo. I mean, I state everything that the patient said verbatim, everything that I said. I use the word repeatedly, such as patient repeatedly advised that backboarding was, you know, appropriate or warranted or whatever, because I don't ever want to have to explain myself further than my report. So I definitely agree that anytime I feel that things didn't go the way that they normally do, I try to paint that picture as beautifully as I can.
Well, and it is Super Bowl season, so I don't remember, gosh, I think it was 2000, 2001, 2002, when you said wazoo. It was the was that E-Trade commercial. The guy, they were like, he's got money coming out his wazoo. Anyway, sorry, yeah. When you said that, it just reminded me of that.
Yeah. Must have missed that in an Abbey class.
Yeah, that's not a very well-known part.
No, exactly. The wazoo is slightly above. Anyway, sorry, I'll shut up now. Well, also joining us, he just came on. Hey. Dr. Kelly Grayson.
Yeah.
Hey, if you say it three times, it's true.
Well, doctor, then.
Yeah, I already said it once before. So you've got one more time. Hey, are you joining us at EMS today, by the way?
Yes, I will be at EMS today.
Yay. Cool. You need to come on a show while you're out there.
Well, yeah, put me on one.
All right,
you're the superstar. I'm just occasional talent.
No, don't you remember? Maybe you didn't get that email. I've been now relegated to the role of talent. We apparently now have people. We have people that handle all the scheduling.
Well, have your people contact my people, and we'll.
Right on. Well, sir, we are talking about documentation tonight.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the role of CQI and what makes good documentation. Does it really talk about what a good medic is? And it's also bring your own topic night. So if we get done with documentation, which we probably won't, but if we do, then you can talk about whatever you want. But first, I'm going to talk about.
I'll jump in.
All right. But first, I'm going to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com. And you came on at the right time, so if you have something to do, you can run and do that real quick. Audible.com has over 85,000 titles from every genre, business, romance, comedy, sci-fi, and more. If you would like a 2-week or 14-day free trial, I guess that's 2 weeks in most people's world, and a credit for a free book, just go to audibletrial.com/EMS garage. Run over there now. And we will get you that free book. Even if you cancel after 14 days, you can keep it forever. You can listen to it on your iPod, your Android, whatever you're using, your Zune. If you still have a Zune, please use it and use it wisely. You can even listen to it on your computer. So run right over to audibletrial.com/EMS garage and get your free book. And we'd really like to thank them for coming along and being with us and being a partner in what we're doing. If you missed last week, my pick of the week was Dead or Alive, and it just seemed to fit. It was from Tom Clancy and really good. You can also, now this week, I'm going to say, how many books were in that whole collection? I think there were like 5 or 6 in the Chronicles of Narnia. So this week I'm going to say Voyage of the Dawn Treader. The movie's coming out this year, so if you want to listen to the book, go ahead and listen to that before you go watch the movie. Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis, and really, really great series.
And I
really enjoy listening to those. Whoa, you have a message. Hello. We heard
sorry,
that.
Sorry, I'm on my... We're on duty posting right now.
Ah, fun. Sorry. Well, hopefully you don't have to go on a call, but that's the fun of the garage. So, Kelly, we were talking about what makes people good documenters versus, you know, are you painting a picture? Are you just documenting pertinent negatives? And I think my last comment, and then Dr. Myers responded, was to say, for me, it's about seeing what people thought and what their process of thinking was versus what they actually did. I get that they probably managed an airway well. I wanted to know why they had to manage the airway. So anyway, tell me what you think about that and what kind of CQI you feel is important, things like that.
Well, aside from you know, monitoring the Sentinel events, the invasive procedures like intubation and the various electrical interventions and stuff that we always track. You probably have to at least track a certain percentage of calls. The only question is what percentage and how much is enough. What makes a good documenter? I tend to agree with you in the regard that you want to see their thought process, and it needs to come across in their writing. That's getting harder and harder to do with the EPCRs that we're asked to use these days. All too few of them have too short of a narrative section for my taste, and you can't really, to my mind, paint an accurate picture of what went on in the call. So seems a little disjointed these days when I document, because I have to put my pertinent negatives and stuff in all the system, body systems information stuff. But hopefully it still paints an accurate picture.
But don't you feel like, I'm going to take a devil's advocate real quick and say, so I think EPCR makes us really good at making sure we document things the same way every time, as long as those same fields are there. However, don't mm-hmm. most of those programs have a place to write a good narrative?
If they're configured that way from the vendor, you find quite a few of them that don't write, that don't have space enough for an adequate narrative.
Really?
I know that, yeah. And I think to a certain extent, that's how the agency specifies it from the vendor. I know of a good friend of mine who just had, I won't name the company, but had one of the major EPCR vendors set up their system, and there's virtually no room for a narrative. At the board, it seems like theirs is the one we use is proprietary. I can't see if it has anything in common with any of the other majors out there, and it has space for a couple of narratives. You have your history and physical in the very beginning, and then you have a room for a short narrative for response to treatment. And I can usually get most of my stuff done then. If I run out of characters, it tells me I'm being a bit long-winded. So I'll kind of tone it down and stick that documentation elsewhere. So.
Well, and I guess
Twitter narrative.
Oh, that's Tim Noonan. Hello, sir. What did you say, Tim?
A Twitter narrative. I've never used an electronic
140 characters chart.
Yeah, I've never used electronic charting that had any limit on characters.
Yeah, ours, well, it's not a Twitter narrative, but it's pretty close. You can get a fairly long paragraph in there. I've never bothered to count how many characters, but it's well more than 140. Which for most of the medics that work with us, you know, of the Twitter generation, that's probably 139 too many. because they, you know, which is, to my mind, is one of the biggest problems with documentation these days, at least QA in it, QI in it, is we're seeing how poorly people are prepared to document out of, you know, the primary and secondary schools, much less medic school.
Now, hey, as a member of that Twitter generation.
Well, now, but you are the exception. You are an exception to the rule. You, Maris, you write well, and you're an English major. you know, there are all too many out there that, you know, their primary means of communication is text speak, and they speak in text speak. I had someone tell me LOL the other day. I'm looking at you.
I think that had I had a different instructor for my EMT course, I would most likely document in a far different capacity, and that she spent an entire week on documentation, both as it pertained to being being able to communicate with other providers, being called into court, things like that. And I'd say she impressed upon us how important it was to not look like an idiot, both when you documented and when you called report. And so even though I am sort of long-winded and even though I am sort of long-winded and superfluous with my writing personally, I think I would not be as detailed as I am if it weren't for the wonderful instruction that I got.
You can have a lot of words. It doesn't make it pertinent.
Right. Yeah.
This is true. Writing concisely yet accurately and thoroughly is an art in and of itself. But, you know, one of the things that I try to make my students do, one of the reason for making my students do so many essays and reports and papers is to teach them to write. How can you formulate a thought and put it on paper? And to my mind, those I have people who complain or send me questions on EMS Newbie all the time that, you know, hey, what do you think of having and do all these papers, and is that really necessary for an EMT class? Yes, it is. And if your instructor makes you do those things, 5 years from now, you'll go back and hug them because they're teaching you how to write. If you don't already know, then you need to know before you become an EMT. You think about how little in the DOT curriculum is actually devoted to the documentation. It's scary. And how often do we see paramedics who they went through basic school, they didn't spend that much time on the street, or they at most had to write a simple short report for an interfacility transfer, even if they even got that kind of experience. And then when they're writing documenting their first code as a paramedic, it may be their first time to document, period. I've got a partner, my current partners, all the last three I've had have been brand new EMTs, and they've all gone to medic school and gotten a paramedic. But were it not for a lot of work, they're documenting their first calls as a paramedic is their first calls to document, period.
Wow.
And that's not a good thing.
So, Dr. Myers, let me ask you the difference between the writing style in an 80,000 call system versus a vastly slower system. Was there any difference, or did you feel that the people that had time to write good reports wrote good reports, or it really didn't matter? It was medic dependent.
I think it was more medic dependent. I mean, you guys hit upon some of the characteristics that I think helps in that. You guys, as well as myself, had good mentors when we were newbies in the field, and who took the time to say, hey, you know, documentation could be better. Here, look at this, or let's try it this way. You know, whether that was in class, out of class, as was said, there's a huge, huge problem with our younger generation in terms of their writing ability and reading comprehension ability. And unfortunately, as EMS educators, we need to work a little bit harder to compensate that those generational issues. But I think it starts with a solid foundation in EMT school, where there's a focus on documentation and writing, and then that continues out into your field preceptorships, and whether that is part of a class or whether it's part of a new job, I think it's essential to to developing good documentation habits.
Dr. Toon, PhD, quick question for you from the EduCast and the research podcast and everything else. Do you think that this really lends itself more to ensuring that we create bachelor's prepared paramedics, or is it incumbent upon us as an employer to train people how to write?
Well, I think that if you wait till everyone gets an associate's or a bachelor's degree, you're going to be short on employees for a period of time. So I think it's going to have to be a twofold approach. I think organizations have a responsibility to have a standard for what they want for their documentation. And I think that, you know, documentation is, you know, there's a number of reasons that we do documentation. And I came in late to this, and I'm sure you've touched on all of that. And I just, I don't think that just because someone has an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree or even a doctoral degree means that they necessarily are good at writing. You know, I mean, I did a, you know, dissertation and stuff, but there's people that you pay to correct all of your syntax and grammar and spelling and stuff, you know, when you go to turn in a paper like that. You certainly can't do that with every report that you're dealing with. So I think that it is incumbent upon the organization to establish their standards everywhere, from what abbreviations are acceptable to be used to how specific things need to be documented. And I also think that we need to be thinking about documentation that we're actually behind the fire service and the police service when it comes to the collecting of data from the documentation. And it's with their powerful data that police and fire services are able to get so much federal money. You know, the fact that we do not know the total number of EMS calls in the United States, how many cardiac arrest calls that exist, and, you know, the list goes on and on. There's no nationwide data bank on that, but boy, there's a pretty good handle on, you know, crime statistics and fire statistics on a national level and even state levels that is even maybe it's probably even more robust. So in there, we have to accomplish documentation to be able to collect money in a true, accurate, non-fraudulent way from insurance companies. We need to be able to communicate to the medical community, physicians, nurses that receive our patients, that there's an accurate reflection of what took place there. And then we also need to be able to collect data that could help us progress our profession across the board. So I think that it's a worthy subject, and it needs a lot of work. I know it's a big thing in our organization, and there is no easy answer to it that I'm aware of. So if one of you have it, please share it with me.
I don't have it, but I'm going to react a quick second to what you said. First off, I don't hope every report is a dissertation. Even though I've written some really long reports, I don't think I've ever wrote a dissertation as a report. Secondly, you can't get to that level unless you know how to write. I mean, you can at least formulate sentences, and you know when something doesn't look right that maybe you should look it up on Google to know how to spell that word, things like that. So I will call the task that I think that eventually we've all got to be there, but I'm going to let the rest of the panel respond.
Well, you know, as far as Googling and knowing how to spell, personally, I think you ought to be able to spell the language of your profession. You know, if there are words you use day in and day out, like vehicle, postictal, apparently, you know, these types of words, you should be able to know how to spell them. If nothing else, write down the ones you have a problem with in the back of your clipboard and refer to it as needed. But I find so many EMTs who can't spell pneumonia, you know, and these are the this is a fairly common problem. The other one being, I don't know if you touched on the subject of abbreviations yet, but abbreviations, you know, are both a bane to a boon to poor spellers, and also a perfect way for a plaintiff's attorney to start to attack your credibility. Why'd you abbreviate that? Can't you spell? Or God forbid, it's a non-standard abbreviation that's, you know, unique to your own service. Dr. Toon mentioned the taking a page from the law enforcement's books as far as data collection. Another thing we could copy from law enforcement documentation is the fact that they don't abbreviate, and they have learned not to do that, as with long experience in courtrooms, and having their documentation assailed by various attorneys, they realize that it is a it's an end to start to attack your credibility. If you read a law enforcement report, which, you know, those things are written with the idea that it will appear in court one day, not can, but will, you'll see very few of them actually abbreviating in them.
And what does that do to the character count of the narrative?
Probably puts quite a bit. Probably wouldn't fit in our reports, that's for sure.
Right. I've seen some of them pretty long, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, if we're going to turn around and say, you know, don't abbreviate and make sure you spell everything out, then, you know, what we need to do is get whoever's creating the forms on the page. And when I say that, I mean not just our agencies, but also the state agencies and, for that matter, Medicare, Medicaid, and all of the insurance companies to accept these elongated narratives. Because I'll tell you, when I started, you know, I had 10 full lines of space where I could turn around and write. I'm now down on my PCRs to 4 lines, and I'm writing in the margins and, you know, writing in places where narrative shouldn't be in order to write a complete narrative.
See,
you know, Dave, you're actually doing a handwritten report. You guys aren't electronic.
Yeah, no, we're still doing handwritten reports. Well, for my one agency, we still use the state PCR, believe it or not. And for my other agency, it's elongated ACR that gets scanned in with OCR. So it's scanned into the computer, and the computer's supposed to be able to read your handwriting as long as you print in big block letters and stuff like that. So
yeah. I have a pet peeve on the electronic stuff.
Why is that, Doc?
Because, or at least when, and I don't know if anybody else had this happen when they switched over from paper to electronic, but when the couple of services switched over here, found the narratives almost disappearing, which was rather annoying, especially on patients where there was we weren't getting a good history from those patients. We really, you know, those are the patients that we really rely on the documentation of the scene from the EMTs and medics. And everybody was focusing so much on clicking the little check boxes, you know, the body outline that was on the tablet, so on and so forth, and they were forgetting about writing a narrative on even just what happened and what, you know, what position the patient was in and what they said when they arrived. So that's my pet peeve. I'll stop the pet peeving now.
Well, I don't disagree. Go ahead, Brad.
As I say, well, Dr. Meyer, part of that is that's not an EPCR problem. That's a service problem and service director problem to not require that. You know, every place that I've worked for the last 7 years or so, we've done EPCR. And if I did not type in a narrative or a full narrative, I'd be sitting down across the guy with the, you know, in the white shirt. I'd be sitting across from the boss being questioned as to why, and no doubt about it. We have to. Now, like, from Kelly's standpoint, I cannot understand who is developing the software that's not allowing you to be able to write a full narrative and that's controlling, you know, like how big. Yeah, and I guess a few other people have sort of mentioned that too. But now that comes down, and I guess even Dr. Meyer, you could even state, look, you guys have to put a more detailed narrative into your reports, or
yeah. It was a long time to change the culture, and anyway, which is kind of unfortunate. And again, I don't know if anybody else went through a similar transition when transitioning over to the electronic, you know, in terms of that. But and we have enough of an issue with as we mentioned, developing good documentation and to rely on a tool incorrectly, unfortunately, exacerbated the issue locally until the word got out.
When you have an electronic chart that you can click things off, people think that they no longer need to do anything about that in the narrative. It's not narrative itself. When you go into court, and you know, I haven't had to go into court to defend any of my charts yet, but they're not going to be asking you to explain what you meant by checking off a box. All it says is that you checked the box off. Maybe you did it accidentally, maybe not. If you documented it, that's going to allow you to express exactly what you mean by what you wrote. And for the ones that don't give you enough room, the words "see continuation form" need to be added at the end.
Yeah. I think the check boxes and the drop down list are the electronic equivalent of WNL. We never looked.
That's good. Well, I kind of agree. I will take you a little to task that I think that good electronic documentation is valuable because, and I'm going to ask Dr. Myers this here in a minute, but it's good because if you have checkboxes and if you use them appropriately and you make sure that your service is using them correctly, then
appropriately.
All right. But
I've got to break in, Chris. I'm gone. We've got a call.
Have fun.
Time to go save lives and stamp out disease.
Save lives, brother. All right, brother.
All right, bye guys.
See you, Kelly. Take care.
So, thanks, Kelly Grayson. If you want to find him, go to ambulancedriver.com. Ambulance driver files?
Ambulance driver files.
Yeah, ambulancedriverfiles.com. Anyway, so my thought is that it makes, we need to have checkboxes for a couple of reasons. One, it kind of validates the input of the data, A. It makes sure that people maybe did it, B. And it's easy to collect the data. See, it doesn't always mean that it's accurate. Doesn't always mean that it's correct. Doesn't always mean that, like Kelly said, that they checked. But
then how does it validate it?
Well, it validates it because when you put, let me put it this way. It's a data validation tool. It's not a check the patient validation tool. So I guess that's a bit of difference. But apparently, too bad you couldn't have something on the patient where if you pushed a button, it checked your ePCR. But I know in our ePCR, it pulls everything over from the random number generator of our 12-lead EKG and the blood pressure, pulse, things like that. So all that's pulled in via Bluetooth. So really, the documentation becomes very minute, except for the narrative. And I always tell people, the narrative is the piece of the report where A, you get to show your style, B, you are liable. I mean, that's the piece that the attorneys are going to put you on the stand for and rake you over the coals. Right or wrong, they're going to do it. And the only times I've been on the stand for my reports have been in criminal cases when I had to go and take care of, say, a shooting victim, and then somebody called the report and I had to go talk about it. And every time, I think I've been on the stand three times in my career, they ask me what every abbreviation is. And if you're not using standard abbreviations, you're going to get hosed every time because the attorney will make you look stupid. And they like to do that. So remember that it's a legal document. And then finally, I think that after you've painted that picture and after you've recognized that it's a legal document, you really want to document everything about that patient that you couldn't do in a checkbox. And quite honestly, that's unfortunately not a lot of things, but it also tends to make it so that you can paint the picture. Checkboxes don't paint a picture. That's a paint by number.
I think all the important stuff is what doesn't go on the checkboxes.
Right. I agree.
You know, it's the subjective presentation of the patient. You know, what does their skin look like? Not checking off pink, warm, dry, whatever. It's describing the things that get your attention, the things that say, hey, I should be paying attention to this.
So I'm going to ask, I'm going to take a little different approach here, and I'll ask Dr. Myers, this is, when do you want to see that report?
Are you foreshadowing my second pet peeve? and I understand this is relatively common occurrence. In New York has a requirement in one of the state policies that the PCR copy is supposed to be left before you leave the hospital. One of the issues that we've had, and I've been trying to work on this as a region, is a lot of the electronic providers, there can be a significant delay from when the crew leaves to when the PCR gets faxed over. It's multifactorial that we've been trying to address, but I understand there's other areas of the country that have a similar problem. But, you can't always get a face-to-face report from the crew. If the emergency department's busy, the crew may have given a report off to the triage nurse. They're assigned a room, they move the patient over. Oftentimes they can give a little bit of a blurb to whoever the primary nurse is for that area, but you're depending upon that person to have the focus to listen to that report. And I might be getting, as the doc going to see the patient, I might be getting information third and fourth hand. I can't always get over there to get the report directly from the crew, so the documentation is very, very important. And old school, that's what I was taught, that's what was banged into my head. You leave it before you go.
And that's a big issue here. We have a number of physicians, particularly the surgeons at the trauma center, the cardiologist for the STEMI patient, they go crazy when they can't find the report in the EKGs. They want it, and they don't want it faxed back to them. They want it right then and there. So one of the things we've started to do is we've started to measure how long does it take someone to finish a patient care report on average. And our average time for all reports, regardless of the acuity of the patient, knowing that there's a range here, the average is about 36 minutes. That's the average. And we use an electronic-based reporting system. And we have an expectation that our crews will complete the report and leave it before they leave the hospital. So, as I said, that's the average is 36 minutes. So think about the number of hours that can be chewed up doing documentation by crews. And I don't have an answer here for this, but we're trying to look at it and see how we can make the system efficient and not onerous at the same time on the practitioners.
We're in the process of doing a region-wide study just to try to get a handle on the times. Because we've got I think there's about three different EPCR vendors that are being used in the area. And I won't name any of them, regardless, but we're trying to get a sense of how long it's actually taken the charts to hit the departments. From our medical advisory committee level for our region, we put together a subcommittee that's looking at that, and we'll hopefully have a report back soon so that we can at least get an idea of what's a reasonable expectation. One of the services is working with one of the hospital systems to transmit the PCR directly into the electronic medical record, which is probably the ultimate really good idea. They're still implementing it. I'm sure there'll be bugs, as with everything else, but just the whole idea of having it, getting it outside the whole faxing issue, where if the fax machine's out of paper, you don't get it. Someone picks it up and puts the chart somewhere, you don't get it into the chart. But getting it actually right into the electronic medical record, it's going to be interesting to see how quickly that occurs. It also can serve as a tickler to the emergency department staff that, hey, the PCR just came up. Let's see what's there if we need some information.
Yeah, we're hoping to do that even here. We had some of the hospitals that would be very interested in ours going right into their electronic medical record system. Cerner's in our area, so
that's actually the system that that they're working with.
Yeah, so that's I just know that there's a big movement around here by the different hospitals to try to do something along those lines. They would really again like to bring it all together, but this is such a we've taken a little bit of a tangent here from just writing the report to the information to all the complexities of this, the documentation aspect of it. And it's a challenging process. There's little question about it. And I don't think if I was to predict, I'm going to say everything eventually is going to go electronic, whether we like it or not.
Can I show you how geeky I am or nerdy? One of the two. The most recent version of NMSIS 3.0 has a specification that all new and current EPCR systems that want to be NMSIS silver and gold have to be HL7 compliant. So that means if they're HL7 compliant, they can import into hospital data systems. And I think then we will have the mostly holy grail of EPCR systems. When we're talking to those hospital systems and we're getting data back from those hospital systems to say, because the bane of my existence is we put all this data in, but then we really don't get a lot of outcome data back. And very that true. To me would be really not, I know we're really going, hey, it's bring your own topic so we can talk about whatever we want. But getting that outcome data would be so awesome from a CQI and a systems development point of view, and looking at the big picture of EMS going, yeah, this is why, if I'm looking at true CQI, okay, here's why you transported this patient, here was their outcome, here were all their laboratory tests, here blah, 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 blah. Yeah, great job. Or, gee, that person could have really gone by POV if you'd have just thought about X, Y, and Z, or what, whatever. And I guess the thought of that is, man, that'll be so exciting. So more power to if you guys figure it out before then. But NMSIS 3.0 is out for comment now. And I have a feeling, last I heard, it'll be implemented sometime summer, mid-fall this year. So that means most of the data vendors will have to come into compliance probably within a few months thereafter. So anyway,
what kind of restrictions will that put on the ability of EMS to obtain information? Because even doctors now have trouble following a patient once they go into other parts of the hospital.
Well,
they have to justify it, and that gets the QA committee or whoever is in charge of spanking people for being curious about what actually happened to their patient involved.
Well, that's where the lawyers have gotten involved, and they get a little too overexcited about it. I have to say that if it's your patient to begin with, it should be your patient through the continuum of care until that episode of whatever happened to that patient is done. So if you had any interaction with that patient's care, you should be able to follow that patient through the continuum of care. Agency or provider, whatever the case may be, I don't know. I mean,
but
maybe
you also
that,
do need some restrictions
we can learn
on that. Because one of the places where I worked, we had the mother of a very famous person there who regularly went to the hospital. And that was the kind of thing where people would get in there to get information if they could have, and, sell it to whatever.
Tabloid,
yes. Thank you.
Dude.
Is willing to pay him a few bucks for it.
Dude, I'm from Vail. We have people here
exactly.
All the time. And you know what? It would be career ending for somebody to do that here. So I don't know. I mean, I guess.
But where
it
are you,
be career ending anywhere.
So that should be the point. So what? So I mean, we can go overboard one way or the other.
We don't think that far ahead. We're EMS.
Tim, okay. It's funny you say that because we just University of Iowa just had 13 football players hospitalized a few weeks ago with similar problems, and the hospital just fired three people who accessed some players' records who weren't supposed to be – they had no reason to be accessing. So they came down pretty hard on three people that they found so far, and then three or four people have been suspended.
Good.
Just because of it. And I agree. Yeah, that's good. You know, and but yet, you know, they shouldn't have access, and yet I can bring in a cardiac arrest to a hospital, and I have to fight tooth and nail or go through back channels just to try to find out some sort of an outcome, because some of the people in the hospital misunderstand what HIPAA really means, and they say that, no, you're not entitled. That's private information. It's like, no, see, my name started in the My name's at the start of this whole process here, and I was involved with it. I think it would be kind of similar as if every time, to go to an opposite end of the spectrum, when we took a patient into the ER, we told the ER staff, I'm sorry, I can't give you this report.
Yeah, because it would be a HIPAA violation.
Yeah, it's a HIPAA violation. You know, I'm not allowed to give you this medical information. You're going to have to ask them yourself. You know, they'd explode.
On the other hand, that is patient abandonment, and that's the thing that I explain to nurses when, you know, especially medical facilities that don't really understand HIPAA as much as the ER does, where they say, well, I can't tell you that information. Here's the patient's information in a sealed envelope. You may not open it. But if you don't give me a report, you have abandoned the patient, and I can go to your state nursing board and tell them. And do you really want to deal with that? On the other hand, depending on what's going on, it's only if it's a stable patient that I take the time to be charming like that.
I was going to say, doesn't Intala say that once they're on the hospital's property, it's their problem anyway?
No, I'm talking about once when I'm picking up the patient. Some places don't want to give report. Gotcha. They say, you don't need to know that. Just transport. You know, you go to a doctor's. Just transport. Well, doctor, if you don't give me a report, you're abandoning the patient. I need to know what's going on because you're transferring care to me, not to the emergency department.
Wow, that's really short-sighted. I mean, that's where I think we kind of get a little disrespect in the healthcare system as an industry, but I'm not going to go there. But I, you know, when did it become such a crime for us to find out what happened to patients? I mean, if we look at traditional healthcare and traditional medicine, they learn from their successes and failures. And we really, the only thing we can look at is successes and failures. And by the way, Brad, if you're the national average, probably between 2 and 5% of the CPR people that you took into the hospital died anyway, or survived anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So anyway, so your follow-up is irrelevant.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But anyway, I digress. The point is, though, we need to learn from every point of our, all along the continuum of care, and there's not many ways we can do that other than to find out what happened to the patient after we dropped them off at the facility or through their continuum of care. Because if we do a refusal, that's even worse because we really can't find out what happened to them then because the likelihood of them calling us back for that same issue is pretty low.
Well, to go like something with that's it's been a hot topic for me, and that's sepsis. After our podcast, I've been doing some presenting on it. You know, if we could get a complete follow-up on all of our patients and get feedback and information back, you know, you might be able to look at how many times a patient ends up being admitted because they're septic and yet we're missing that or not treating it, you know, and then that could in turn change some education, change some treatment patterns, just change how we're doing our job because we're, you know, something is telling us that you need to do a better job with this sort of illness or this injury or something, and it can change and push us. And right now, that unfortunately, that's non-existent. I mean, I'm hoping in the future that this can all be a nice, complete, happy, full circle with the communication and the feedback, and we're actually able to see at an end point how good of a job we're doing.
Yeah, if you look at the deaths and mortality numbers from the CDC, they have two of the top 10 are septicemia and how many of those are septic patients when they're dying? If you can make a big difference in the septic patients, probably saving more lives than you are with good CPR and rapid defibrillation.
Oh, yeah, I agree completely, Tim. I completely agree. And a lot of the research and data that's out there is showing that there should be a huge push towards the proper recognition and treatment of sepsis. But we can digress into that on a whole other night.
So, bringing this podcast to a close, unless there's any other thoughts on CQI documentation, data entry, and the like, and I already named the podcast episode Paint by Number, just so you know.
Has anybody mentioned that a refusal doesn't mean that you talk to medical command and they approved it and that's it?
Oh.
That the refusal should actually be much longer than your regular documentation, because this is a patient who's not going to be seen by a nurse who will write a chart on it, who's not going to be seen by a doctor who will write a chart on it. Yours is going to be the only documentation. So there is no supporting document to suggest that what you're saying is even close to the truth.
Sounds like a good topic for a podcast.
That sounds like another podcast completely, but I do agree.
Okey-doke.
Yeah, that is another podcast, and I can plug that later, Chris.
Oh, uh-oh. All right. Well, since you said it, you get to plug first. So, Brad Buck, where can people find you, and what podcast are you talking about?
EMSstandingorders.com, and you can find the EMS Standing Order podcast, which kind of has a focus on medical direction. And you'll be able to find us at the end of the month, Matt and I, my co-partner in that, at the Gathering of Eagles down in Dallas. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and all the others.
Cool. I'm excited that you guys are going to the Eagles.
As are we. We are very excited. It's going to be a great opportunity and a good time.
Right on. And the remarkably quiet David Koenig, where can people find you?
I don't know. All over the place, it seems.
Are you coming to EMS today?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. No, you're on my show. Never mind.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely going to be at EMS today. I don't know who to plug. I mean, I'm on Twitter, David Koenig, EMSblogs.com, socialmedic.net, and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Right on, dude. Thank you. Dr. Jeff Myers, where can people find you?
I can be found on my website at photoemsdoc.com, photoemsdoc.com. Also on Facebook, I will be at EMS Today, as well as around a few other conferences for this year.
Very cool. And you need to get on Brad's podcast because you're a medical director.
I know I missed the last one, and hopefully if I do not have a meeting put right in the middle of when it's scheduled again for next week, I'll be able to join them on that one.
That'd be great. That'd be excellent to have you on.
It looks like you've got a good lineup for Monday, so that'll be exciting.
Hey, thanks a lot, Brad. I'm kind of bummed. I've never been invited. Thanks a lot. Appreciate
it. Right now, I'll be honest, the only people that really get, hey, you were on our inaugural podcast.
I know, I'm teasing.
You sat over in the corner.
I know. I was really quiet.
Eventually, we'll start to invite more. Right now, the only invites we've really done are to the physicians.
And
it's to continue to build up until we really get a good following, get used to it, get going. And then I've got about 18 or 20 people on my list that will then be added into the weekly emails.
Right on. Cool. Maris Schwuga? Schwuga? Where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter, Medic61. My blog, samtheemt.com, which I have shamefully not updated in a while, but I promise it's not dead. And, of course, on GenMed, check us out, genmedshow.com, and we will be at EMS today, having a great time meeting people, podcasting, and generally just getting into wonderful, wonderful situations. So, anyway, that's where I will be.
I have a feeling there's going to be pictures, lots of pictures.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We will be twit-picking like crazy.
Great. Awesome. Cool. Tim Noonan, where can people find you? And are you coming to EMS today? Did I ask you that last week? I don't remember.
I will be at EMS today. I'll probably be hanging around the EMS History Museum. And I will not be able to make the EMS Research podcast down there because I'm going to have to work unless I can find somebody to cover for me. Friday afternoon's a bit difficult to get coverage for.
Right on. Completely.
And I'm available at roguemedic.com and paramedicine101.com and other places that even I forget sometimes.
Very cool. Dr. Toon, since you didn't get to introduce yourself tonight, where can people find you and, you know, whatever you want to talk about?
Thank you. Well, I'm encouraging people to use the Facebook site for either EMS Educast or the EMS Research podcast as a good way to contact me. I'm also on Twitter, not as prolific as some people that are out there. I won't mention their names, but she's not there tonight. So, but you can find me at WFToon. No, to answer your question, I will not be at EMS today.
Has anybody ever told you you have that voice from NPR? You sound like that guy from NPR. I can't think of his name right now. You have almost uncannily the same voice as that guy. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Has anybody ever told you that, or are you that guy?
No, like, I've not heard that before, but thank you very much.
All right, right on. Okay, cool. Well, I'm Chris Montero, Geeky Medic, and that's it. So join us next week when we talk more about issues that concern you. Have a great day, night, weekend, whatever you're doing.